Welcome to the President's Podcast of the Tarrant County Young Lawyers Association, also known as the TCYLA. My name is Austin Gardner, and I'm the current president of the TCYLA. The goal of this podcast is to discuss all things legal in Tarrant County, Fort Worth, Texas. Today's topic is for the series, Things I Wish I Knew as a Young Attorney. Today, I'm joined by my guest, Taylor Ferguson, to discuss expecting the unexpected. Taylor, thank you for joining our podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. I'm excited. So this should be fun.
Yeah. So you've been doing criminal for quite some time.
Yes. I started with the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office straight out of law school in 2006. And I worked there for 9 years. And I left in 2015 and started my own criminal defense practice. And so I've been doing nothing but criminal prosecution, defense, and juvenile law my whole career. So
yeah, and I'm sure you get a ton of weird facts and weird cases and fun cases and that hit your caseload, but there's a few cases I kind of want to talk to you about. The first one is how you became a witness in a murder trial. Let's start by saying, approximately when this was and kind of the facts leading up to the case.
Sure. And we had kind of talked about some of this stuff ahead of time that, you know, I was hoping to tell some funny stories, but also give some practical tips as, you know, being a prosecutor, some of the challenges that you run into, some of the, you know, unexpected things that do happen in cases, how to react and how to be prepared to kind of hope that you can minimize those surprises at times. But this case would have probably been, so I was in at the time Criminal District Court 3. That would have probably been somewhere around 2012, 2013, somewhere in there, maybe a little bit before. But I was handling some cases for grand jury, one of which was a murder. And just a very quick rundown of the circumstances, the defendant in that case owned or worked at a body shop, repair shop over in sort of the southwest or southeast part of Fort Worth, like right off of I-35. And he worked at this body shop, and the victim was either a former employee or I don't really remember his connection, honestly, but he showed up and they got into an argument and the defendant ended up shooting the victim right there on the property, and the victim died, passed away. And so ultimately the guy was charged with murder. And in his defense, he said, you know, the victim brought a gun to the shop and we started arguing and he pulled that gun out. And then I wrestled it away from him and I shot him in self-defense. That was his entire argument, essentially. So as I was getting the case ready, one of the things you do at the grand jury level, especially on cases like this, is there might be witnesses that you would like to have provide testimony to the grand jury. We do that oftentimes as prosecutors to, you know, get their story on the record. Nail it down so that if they want to walk something back later or change what they remembered, that's a good time to get a sworn statement. And so that was something we did all the time. Well, so I was working with an investigator, finding various witnesses that, you know, were at the shop or things, hunting people down. And one of the guys that I came across, you know, I mentioned to him, we were talking about the gun and whether I was asking whether or not he saw the victim bring the gun or saw it fall out of his waistband or what happened. And he said, oh, no, that's the defendant's gun. That gun was in the shop. And I know that for a fact because we used to take it out back and do target practice with it and all the time. I said, okay, well, that's interesting.
And that's the first time you heard of the change of who had the gun and who owned the gun.
Correct. That would have been the first time. I mean, I think we kind of suspected that the defendant wasn't necessarily being completely honest on that front, but this was the first time that anybody had heard this information. And actually that witness was real hesitant to talk. Like everyone in this case was extremely uncooperative. And the prosecutor that ended up actually taking this case to trial is a guy named Josh Ross, who was a good friend of mine in the office and now works at a civil law firm. But he has probably his own story of this case, of the nightmare of trying to get some uncooperative witnesses. You know, there was a girl that lived in Louisiana that we had to serve her and have a marshal meet her at the airport. And there was another guy who refused to testify and actually got put in jail. Like, you know, in the criminal world, you subpoena and their failure to comply with that subpoena means that they can be attached and they can sit in jail until it's their turn to testify. That almost never happens, but it happened in this case. So this was a difficult case, but anyhow, so this witness was a little hesitant to tell me that, but he tells me anyway. So my investigator and I say, hey, let's go back to the crime scene and let's look around. Let's see what's back there where they said they were shooting this gun.
So you are working with an investigator. Is this like a police officer or someone that works in the office? How does that work?
No, so it's a Tarrant County employee. The district attorney's office hires, they're all peace officers. Most of them are retired police officers or something of that nature, but they work for the district attorney's office. So no, I'm dealing with my own investigator. We had one assigned to our court that would handle kind of everything. And I honestly don't remember which investigator it was, to be honest.
But sure.
Anyhow, I do remember it was the summer and it was super hot, like 100+ degrees. And we go out there and behind the shop where this target practice would have taken place was this gravel, you know, it was a body shop and there was junk everywhere, but there's just this gravel area. And so I'm sort of like, well, let's just start looking. And I actually get down on my hands and knees actually and start kind of moving the gravel around and looking, and sure enough I find a shell casing. It was a 9mm casing. I had to move the gravel and sort of pull it out to make sure that it met the the caliber that we were looking for, and sure enough there it is. So I'm like, okay, well, this could potentially be tied to the murder weapon. So I call Fort Worth crime scene and have one of their officers meet me out there to actually collect it. So, you know, we can establish a chain of custody basically and collect it and book it in as evidence and all of that. But then I kind of realized okay, well, I'm kind of a witness in this case now, especially if this comes back to match the murder weapon. And, you know, it's kind of tough to be the prosecutor on a case and a witness at the same time.
Right.
So I sort of wrapped up my responsibilities as a prosecutor on that case and turned it over to my court team. And sure enough, the casing matched. And sure enough, that case went to trial, you know, a year or so later. And yes, I ended up being called to testify because that, you know, kind of debunked the defendant's entire self-defense theory. So,
right. So let me kind of go back a little bit. You mentioned this case was a grand jury case. How does that differ from being the prosecuting attorney? Like, for those who may not know what a grand jury is and what their role is, could you explain that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the grand jury is really a unilateral proceeding. All felony cases in Texas, you have the right to have your case presented to the grand jury, and the grand jury is going to be, 12 citizens from the county who are listening to the case, but they're deciding whether or not they think there's enough evidence to go forward, whether it has probable cause to issue an indictment.
Which probable cause is a really low burden. I mean,
right. Yeah, it is. It's just enough, you know, to get you there over the hump, basically. But yeah, so it's a secret proceeding. No one's allowed to be in there except for the prosecutor, the grand jurors, and then any potential witnesses that you may have called. But they are just deciding whether or not they want to issue indictments. And the standard is probable cause. However, you know, when I worked there, I sort of functioned under the concept of if a case was going to get indicted, it needed to be something that you could prove and you could win. And even if there would be times a case might maybe has probable cause, but it still creates other issues. Perhaps a grand jury might be persuaded to not indict that case. But but when I worked at the DA's office, we took turns handling cases specifically for grand jury because it's a tough job. It's hard to get through all those cases, and you would sort of rotate through. And on murder cases or bigger cases like that, my chief at the time, which was Christy Jack, would want me to really work that case. Like, we want to have this thing ready to go the moment it gets out of grand jury. So that's what would lead to me interviewing witnesses, putting them, you know, getting their testimony. You're not doing that on every single case because you flat out just don't have time. But for the bigger things like murders, you're going to want that stuff ahead of time so that you don't get caught with surprises later down the road. So,
and when you're working for, a place like the DA's office, you get really good at building your case. And I would suspect that, when you're, even though you have a much lower burden with your grand jury cases, you are kind of preparing and building that case that way you can just pass it off pretty easily.
Absolutely, because you move around a lot at the DA's office, and oftentimes cases that you handled at one level no longer become someone else's case at a later date. So you would like to leave them in a state where if someone's picking this up, they know what you've done and how you've gotten it ready to go. And that goes into also just preparation in general. I went back and listened to your podcast with James Teal prior to this, and you guys talked a bunch about mentors, you know, finding a mentor or having a, you know, how does that go about? I couldn't agree more of latching on to some, you know, more experienced lawyers and just learning from them is invaluable. And in my particular case, Christy Jack was my chief for several years, and the level of preparation that she put into cases and then forced upon me to put into cases has definitely made me a better lawyer on that front. So.
Right. I've always said no one gets anywhere alone. And I think the legal industry is definitely an example of that too, because yeah, I've never met an attorney that opens their own practice and has never had someone really kind of help them get to a level where they're, you know, at a level of being respected in the community without having those handful of people that can really speak the truth and help them to better their practice and their cases and be better attorneys, be better counselors for their clients.
For sure. And I feel now, having done this for 17 years, there are people that come to me and ask questions. And I'm like, why are you asking me? I'm still a baby. And then I realize, maybe I'm not. Maybe I've been doing it for a long time.
Right.
But you're absolutely 100% that stuff helps. Now, I wanted to add one other sort of final kind of funny note to this particular case, mm-hmm. which is about when I actually did testify, because that's the only time I've ever testified in a trial. And I think I proved to be like, you don't want to have to interview a witness, a lawyer as a witness, because we are like, you know, we can be difficult. Anyway, I'll explain. So I was put under the rule in this case. And for those of you that don't know, the rule is basically if you're a witness in a trial, you're not allowed to be in the courtroom except for when you testify. And you're not supposed to talk to other witnesses about their testimony or your testimony. And the concept being that you're going in there testifying about what you know and what you know alone. So I was placed under the rules. So I didn't watch any of this trial. You know, I was working in the office. And then when Josh told me, hey, you're up, I went up, you know, went upstairs and went into the courtroom and got sworn in and sat down to testify. Well, so Josh hands me an envelope with a crime scene officer's signature on it and a bullet case, a shell casing in the envelope. And he says, you know, is this the casing that you found at the crime scene on this particular case? And I respond, I don't know. And he stops and he looks at me. He's like, what do you mean you don't know? And I said, well, if the crime scene officer who testified before me said that this is the casing I pointed out to him, then yes, it is the casing that I pointed out to him. But I don't know what he said because I wasn't in here when he said it. And Josh looks at me with this look like afterwards, he's like, why did you have to make that so difficult? And I was like, but that was the truth. Like, yeah. I don't know what he said. Like, I know what I did, and that's all I can talk about. So anyhow, I just remember being real frustrated with me for making that to seem a little more difficult than it needed to be.
So, yeah, I can imagine him just being like, couldn't you just say probably, you know, I think yeah, I know. this looks like the shell casing that I picked up, but I'm not for sure.
The lawyer in me had to do it the right way. So anyhow.
Well, and that's what you want. Like when I prep witnesses and caseworkers and things like that, I let them know, like, the most important thing, the first most important thing you should know when you're testifying is tell the truth. And if you don't know, you don't know. I don't know is a perfectly acceptable answer. Don't say yes when you don't know. That's a good example of that. So there's another case that I kind of want to get into that involves Brady evidence. And before we get into that, I kind of wanted to have a discussion. What is Brady evidence and how does that play into criminal trials?
Right, absolutely. So Brady is based off of a famous Supreme Court case, Brady versus Maryland. And in the criminal prosecution world, everybody knows what the word Brady means. But I'm not sure outside of that world if your average lawyer, you know, knows what it stands for. But it's essentially, it puts the duty on the prosecution to provide any exculpatory and or mitigating evidence to the defense, which seems like that makes perfect sense. Why on earth wouldn't they? But there's been many, many, many cases over the years where prosecutors sometimes haphazardly, sometimes very, very willingly withheld exculpatory information, and in some high profile cases even led to innocent human beings being convicted of, you know, horrible crimes. And so Brady versus Maryland kind of set that standard to require prosecutors to turn that information over to the defense counsel. And ultimately, that ended up getting kind of codified in our state, here in the state of Texas, under what's called the Michael Morton Act, which is a discovery act, but is essentially designed to ensure that prosecutors don't withhold this kind of information. And just a very quick aside, it's named after Michael Morton, a man that was wrongfully convicted of murdering his wife and spent probably almost 30 years, I think, in prison. Because the prosecutor withheld some completely exculpatory evidence in that particular case. And so that's the premise behind Brady. It's designed to not have those situations happen. It's something that as a prosecutor gets stressed over and over and over in your mind, do not ever violate this statute. That would be the worst possible thing you could do. Not only grounds for getting fired, but maybe even something worse, something prosecuting or your license or even criminal charges have come out of people withholding Brady information. So I remember as a young prosecutor sort of kind of being scared whenever I go to trial. I would have never willingly withheld information, but what if I missed something or I forgot to say this or tell the prosecutor that or the other things like that nature, especially in trial, things are coming at you really fast. And so it would make you nervous. So anyhow, that's Brady in a nutshell.
Right. And Brady is, to be clear, it's one-sided. You know, the state has the burden, or not burden, but responsibility to turn over all the exculpatory evidence, where the defense does not have that same burden. They can have that surprise witness. They can have that surprise DNA test that comes out. And second thing that I think is important to note about Brady is where there is, or at least there was before the Michael Morton Act, that the exculpatory is really kind of open for some interpretation. And that's where a lot of people get in trouble, I think, when Brady comes into play, is that some people found some evidence, oh, that's not really exculpatory, and where in effect it is.
Yes, and you're absolutely right on that front. And even more troubling is, and this is going to sort of tie into the story that we're going to talk about, police officers don't always recognize what is potential Brady. You know, a detective might interview a witness in a case, and the witness is like, says, oh, that guy didn't do it. I know for a fact that he didn't do it. And the detective makes a note of it, but he doesn't think anything else of it and doesn't realize that, you know, that could be very exculpatory. But they don't think, you know, they don't think twice. They don't include it in their report. You as the prosecutor don't know anything about it. And that creates a huge problem, which especially part of the statute essentially puts that duty on the prosecutor to whatever's in the law enforcement's file, you are sort of presumed to know about. So you can't stand back and say, well, the detective never told me that somebody, you know, wrongly identified this guy, or so I'm not held out to be responsible for that. That's not true. Under kind of the way that Michael Morton is structured now, which is sort of the lesson that I want to give on this particular front, which also with a sort of, you know, comical story, I guess, is in preparing for trial, get the detective's file. Don't let him say, hey, I've given it to you. Say, nope, bring it to me. Bring me the whole thing to my office. I'm going to look through it myself, because I'm not going to rely on you, the detective, to determine what is and what isn't important information. I'm going to make that determination. So
there was a case in general that you were involved with, that in the Brady case that we're going to discuss, where it involves some fingerprints. Kind of go into detail what that case was about and how Brady came into effect.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was a series of robberies. There were a couple of defendants who were doing it. And actually what they were doing was pretty frightening. They would go to like grocery stores and follow women or elderly people who were going grocery shopping. They'd follow them to their car, they'd follow them home, and then rob them in their driveway. And, you know, it was not cool. I mean, this was a bad guy. He was not a good guy. And that's, you know, kind of a heinous crime, in my opinion. They committed robberies in both Arlington and Fort Worth, I believe, if I remember correctly. So there was multiple detectives are working on the case at the same time. And it might have been all Fort Worth, but somehow more than one detective was handling this investigation. And so the primary detective, I did exactly what we were talking about. He brought his file to my office and we looked through it all. Oh, and I guess I need to add one other thing. At the time when they finally solved the case, they arrested this defendant. It was, you know, days later or maybe weeks after the series of robberies had happened, and they arrested him in a car, and they took some latent prints from that car. And what I mean by that is crime scene would have come out and put basically they dust the car for prints, for easiest way to put it. And then they can submit those for processing later to see if there's any comparisons. So that they took some of those. I meet with the detective on this case, the primary detective, and I say, hey, what happened with those latent prints? He said, oh, there was nothing. We didn't submit them. They're just sitting there and said, okay, whatever, that's fine. We don't need them. You know, we had something, we had enough evidence, we're good. And the defense attorney asks me that exact question, says, hey, what happened with those latent prints? And I email him back and said, they never submitted them. You know, okay, you know, and that's defense. I've done what I'm supposed to do. You know, I've told the defense counsel, he asked the question and I've answered it. So we get to trial. And one of the other detectives who was working this case on a different, from a different angle, he was going to testify for some reason. I don't remember exactly why, but he's walking into the courtroom. Like I call the judge says, call your next witness. And I say, judge, I call detective so-and-so. He's walking into the courtroom. As he's walking past me, he's like, hey, here's that latent print report from the fingerprints we took from the car. And he hands me the report. And I'm like, wait, the other detective told me that y'all didn't do this. And he's like, no, we went ahead and ran them, but don't worry, it's not the defendant. And I was like, oh, no. Like, because in his head, he's like, oh, it's not the defendant, so it doesn't matter. But in my head, I'm like, no, it matters a lot because that's potentially exonerating him. If this is this car that's been used to commit all these robberies and there's someone else's fingerprints in there, and I've already represented to the defense counsel that this never happened, and you're telling me this literally 1 minute before you're getting on the stand.
Right.
So it gives, you know, my anxiety goes up to 10,000 at that point. And it was all because, I mean, again, in the end, it's mea culpa because I didn't look at his file. I only looked at the lead detective's file. But, you know, so there's the lesson. And just so you know, just on how to handle that, I asked for a timeout. I turned to the defense counsel. I said, remember when I told you there was no latent prints? That turns out is not true. Here's the report. It's not your client. And I told the detective, I'm going to let the defense counsel ask whatever questions he wants about this. You're getting no protection from me. You're on your own. So, like, anyhow, so that was the best way I could remedy the situation at that point. So.
And I bet when soon as he says, you know, don't worry, they're not the defendants. You can just feel the blood rush into the back of your neck. And you're like, oh, 100%. Gosh, how am I going to get out of this one?
I know 100%. Because again, you don't like that's I'm not knowingly violating Brady in that scenario. Like I believed I had done everything I was supposed to do. But then all of a sudden I'm handed something and I'm like, oh. This is Brady. So you just, you know, it's okay. I mean, immediately turn it over, you know, but what you don't do in that scenario is shove it under the desk and just keep going. That's when you start getting serious trouble. So,
and I think that sometimes, and it, luckily, I think it's so rare that prosecutors get stuck in that. I need to win my case, right? I need to be a good soldier and get a conviction, and how easy it would be to just put it underneath your table and make that absolutely wrong decision. And that's, you know, it's such a easy way to lose your license, to get disbarred and just to take that extra second to be like, we need to take a time out. It's a lesson I think every attorney needs, more especially prosecutors.
I agree. And I also sort of to be philosophical a little bit, you know, when you sign on to be a prosecutor, you take this oath, and your oath is not to seek convictions. It's not to put people in prison. It's to see that justice is done. And so I always took this sort of mindset when it came to Brady of, you know, well, I didn't create this Brady. Like this is just the facts of the case. And my job is to see that justice is done. So why on earth would I not turn this over? No conviction is worth not adhering to my oath. But you are correct. Prosecutors can feel some pressure in some circumstances, and you hope don't knowingly or willingly make those type of decisions. But anyhow.
Right. All right. The last case I want to talk about is kind of that surprise in trial that you never expect on getting a something wrong. So you have a case where you're entering evidence and something goes askew. Let's talk about that case.
Yes. And sort of my life lesson on this one is to look at your evidence ahead of time. And then sort of just the story behind it. So I tried a case and it was a felony driving while intoxicated case. And the police had taken this guy's blood. It was out of Haltom City. And we were taking the case to trial. So the prosecutor I was trying the case with, we went to Haltom City ahead of time to look at the evidence because they, when they collect the blood, they keep it. And they keep it so the defense counsel could have a chance to test it if they want. That, you know, for whatever reason, they hang on to that blood. And that's something that we're going to enter into evidence in trial, you know, as part of the part of our case, I guess, for lack of a better term. So we want to go out there ahead of time, make sure it's there, make sure the police haven't lost it, all those things. We go out there, we check it out. We have the officer meet us there. He, you know, we open up the package, we look at everything. Officer says, yeah, that's my signature right there. I remember this. We took the blood, you know, they had him seal it back up. You know, say, okay, great. Make sure you bring that to court with you for trials. Officer says, sure, no problem. Their custodian would have, evidence custodian would have checked it out to him, and he comes to trial and he's up there testifying and we're going through the motions and I'm asking him the predicate, you know, there's just random questions that you ask to kind of lay the foundation. Hey, do you recognize this? Yes, I do. How do you recognize it? Like, well, that's my signature. And, you know, is this the evidence you collected in this case? Yada, yada, yada. Moving on into evidence. But I asked him one of those questions. I said, hey, you know, is this your signature? And he pauses. And then he says, yes. And then we keep going. And we don't think, you know, anything of it. But I was confused why he paused for a second. And now I kind of, as I'm going in my head, I'm looking at it. I'm like, you know, where's the evidence tape from when we opened this the other day? I don't see it. Because we would have opened it and resealed it. So anyway, I passed the witness and he asked questions. And then on a break, I kind of say, let me look at that real quick. And I have the officer still there and I look at it and I'm like, this isn't you didn't sign this. And he said, no, I you're right. That's why I hesitated. I was confused because that doesn't look like my signature. So, well, what's going on here? And I look, the name on the packaging is the name of the defendant. I know we went and looked at this the week before. So, well, what's going on here? So I call the custodian and I say, hey, something's not right here. And she looks and she's like, oh, my God. She says, we had another defendant with the exact same name. And I sent his blood to court. Like, are you kidding me? So I just put the wrong blood into evidence in this case. And I'm like, what are the coincidences or the odds that you've got two suspects with the exact same name? And then she's like, I know I got it wrong. I'm on my way. I'm bringing the right blood. I'm like, okay, so what do I do now? So again, I have to tell the defense attorney, hey, we screwed up, put the wrong blood into evidence here. Turns out there were two guys with the same exact name and the custodian grabbed the wrong one or gave the wrong one to the cop. And she's on her way down here with the right one. How do you want to handle this? And I'm to the defense attorney. And he's like, well, did they test the other guy's blood? And I said, yeah, I guess we're going to have to find out. So I get him to run the report. And sure enough, they did. And not only did this guy have the same name, he had the exact same blood alcohol level as the defendant. So now I'm like, oh, no, this is melting down. So I give that to the defense counsel. And I said, hey, you can just put that into evidence. Like you don't need any witnesses. Just whatever, just put it in. There's nothing I can do about this at this point. Again, the custodian gets up there, takes it on the chin. I let the defense attorney say anything and everything he can. I let him get into evidence that this other person had the exact same blood alcohol score as his client. And we move on from there. And anyhow, the jury did end up finding that guy guilty, but it got reversed on some other grounds. It didn't have anything to do with this, so don't worry. But my final point on that story is the judge, it was a visiting judge, and after the trial, he gave me and the other prosecutor, this, award that he made up, which was the, like, he called it the poker face of, I've never seen two prosecutors keeping their cool and acting like nothing is wrong as all of this is just totally melting down. That you're looking, the jury thinking like, oh, this is completely normal that they put the wrong blood into evidence in this case. So anyway.
And I think that also brings up another good point that so many, I think, young attorneys especially get so focused on writing down every word that is being spoken by the attorneys and by the witnesses. Sometimes they miss the small things like that pause that you noticed that was like, that's a little, it leaves you a little like, well, why? Like this should be a no-brainer question that he's having to think about. There's something a little bit more, and if you're writing down every word, sometimes you miss things like that.
Absolutely. And body language is important too, because that was that particular, that's exactly what happened. Is he, you're right. I was, these are questions you just bang out, bang through, you don't even think about. And then when he hesitates, and then I hesitate, and now I'm like, okay, something's not right here. We got to figure this out. So anyhow,
The
you're right.
spidey senses start tingling.
Correct. So.
Well, I think those are all very good lessons. And I want to thank you for your time on coming onto the podcast. I think this is going to be very valuable stuff for whether you be a young attorney, an older attorney, or even not even an attorney at all. I think these are all good lessons professionally to just do the right thing. I guess it's a summary of all three of these things and kind of expect the unexpected. Would you agree?
Yes, for sure. And I appreciate you having me. This, like I said in the beginning, that this was going to be fun, and it is fun. I hope that somebody learns some lesson from this, or at least is entertained for 45 minutes. So.
Right. Well, this has been Austin Gardner with the Tarrant County Young Lawyers Association President's Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to our series, Huh? Things I Wish I Knew as a Young Attorney. We hope you subscribe to our podcast and join us for future episodes. I want to thank our guest, Taylor Ferguson, for joining us today. Taylor Ferguson was born and raised in Fort Worth, Texas. He graduated UT Austin in 2003 with a major in psychology. He graduated Texas Tech School of Law in 2005, then worked for the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office from 2006 to 2015, where he did misdemeanor, felony, and juvenile prosecutions. Taylor tried approximately 80 jury trials before leaving and opening up his own practice in 2015. For more information on what is happening with our organization, please check out our website at www.tcyla.org. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on a brand new episode of the TCYLA's President Podcast. Have a great day.